Don't complain to your head.
This was you.
All right. First of all, it's,
You're the DMV guy?
Sorry?
It was niche of mine, by the way. They print my ticket.
Is that on it?
It's on. No, they print my ticket, my number of house. It literally was pretty. Is that
okay. Eitan Alstein. Eitan? Okay, Brett, how are you? Thank God, okay. Yonatan Block, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Thank God. Andrew Eisen. Okay, Joseph Ellie, how are you? Welcome back. Avi Fetter, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Okay, Gabriel Feld. Okay, Joseph Feuerstein. Sasson Gabay. Chesky Glatt. How you doing? Still back there? Alexander Goldberg. Okay, Nathaniel Goldstein. Dubin, how you doing? Abraham Khan, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Okay, Manuel Kozlow, how you doing? Ilan Regenbaum, what's new? Zev Rosenblum. How are you? Aaron Watson.
Sorry?
I was here before. Okay, Benjamin Weisinger. How you doing? Excellent. Ariel Sensino. Alex Kasowitz. How you doing?
Good.
Okay, am I missing anyone? All right. So we have on our agenda, between now and Maariv, to discuss essentially Gnevis Das. So basically we discussed most of that last week. We just wanted to talk about some practical examples. And also then to get into Ribbis. Ribbis is a major topic. We'll see how long it takes us, how much we can talk about it, but it's very important whether you're in business or alive. So if you're in any of those two categories, it tends to come up a lot. So we'll try to talk a little bit about some of the principles there. But first of all, just to finish off our Gnevis Das discussions, so question already.
You want to ask a question on Gnevis Das?
Yes.
How does like being anonymous tie into that? So if you make a request to, say, someone who you work for or whatever, but you submit something anonymously, we could put down a note on your desk before you walk in or through an intermediary. Anonymous students request that X be changed.
Well, why would that be Gnevis Das per se? It may not carry so much weight.
Well, you want to misrepresent yourself.
But yeah, misrepresenting, you're leaving out information which is clear that it's left out.
Right.
You know, you're not
because the person's interpretation, which could be
correct. But you know, you're not necessarily. I mean, I'm not necessarily advocating anonymity, and depending on the context. But in terms of being Gnevis Das per se, so you're not deceiving anybody or creating any false impressions. You're, unless you use the opportunity to create a false impression. Anonymity can be a tool for a lot of falsehood.
Well, I'm not saying but not, that you're saying all the students in the class are, when it's really one or two.
No,
what I'm saying is that
you're not necessarily saying that. You're saying you're leaving open the possibility that it could be anyone, which may plant kind of a suspicion in everybody in everybody's mind, which is another reason why it's not always the best thing in the world. But it's not, you're not creating necessarily a false impression or an impression that's reasonably false. And the fact that the person has no idea who it is, there's no reason for him to think that it's more than whatever it says. You know what I mean? If one person leaves this note, so if it states that it's representing more people than it is, so then that's false. If it creates the impression just by its anonymity that it could be more than one person, is that true? Why would that be true?
Well, Well, when you leave a vague note, you say, like, several concerned individuals.
So that's not a question of anonymity. That could be true even if you sign it. Right? If you're not representing things accurately, so then that's deceptive regardless of whether your name is on it or not.
Okay.
Right? If you were to sign a note that said, several students agree with me that...
Right, and it's definitely one or two, and you give a representation, that's much more.
So then that would be a deception issue regardless of whether your name is on it or not. Now, it happens to be that anonymity does create a context in which it's easier to be deceptive because, like, he can't be confronted directly about it. And it does leave kind of a question mark on everybody's heads. So that is true. All right, so let's talk about some examples in addition to that, some other possible examples of Gnevis Das. One interesting example, which is discussed in some of the literature, I find this interesting because I think this is definitely wrong. I think it's a fair question whether it's Gnevis Mammon or Gnevis Das. What if you are selling something by auction and you have somebody who's in cahoots with you in the audience out there bidding on the item in an effort to drive up the price? So that seems to definitely be an issue on some level. That's an issue that some of the posts can point out. It's an interesting question whether it's Gnevis Das or Gnevis Mammon. I'm not 100% sure. The reason it's Gnevis Das is because... You also want to answer that question?
No, I was going to ask, I don't see why it is at all.
Why it's neither?
Yeah.
Alright, so the reason it's Gnevis Das is because essentially I'm trying to sell you this item, whatever it is, and you are going to pay what it's worth. And the point of the auction is to kind of establish the market. That's generally what the premise of an auction is. Right? To say, this room will be the market, and whoever will pay the most, that represents what the outer limits of the market.
But it's different from evaluating the price of the object versus how much the person is willing to pay for it. In an auction, it's not set price.
But value is
the value of the object.
No, but value is largely dependent on what people will pay.
So that's the people's problem. I mean, why is that?
Because if they think I should pay it because other people are willing to pay X and they're not really their actors, so then I'm falsely driving up the price.
Wait, you're
misled. I want to auction off this pen right now, right? So I'll sell you this pen. So you'll pay me what you think it's worth and what we agree it's worth. But let's say I auction it off. So presumably no one here is in on it, so whatever number we come up with will be a reasonable number. But if I have somebody who's in cahoots with me, who's going to keep pushing the price up, so the guy who's ultimately going to pay for it is paying a very inflated price, which he thinks is a reasonable price to pay, because it must be worth something because other people in the room have been willing to pay for it also. But it's totally false. Nobody's willing to pay for it.
So assuming he's an idiot
a little bit. Doesn't have to be an idiot. He doesn't have to necessarily know. I mean, that, you could say that about anything here. And anything in Onar and Gnevis Das. You know, assuming...
No, I mean, like, it's...
The premise of everything in Onar and Gnevis Das is that there is some information that is concealed from the purchaser. So here that's no different. You know, he doesn't know what's involved. He sees there are other people who are willing to pay a lot for it, so it's, apparently it is worth that. And it's all a scam. So that is really kind of a straight-out model of Gnevis Das. That's any time where we're creating the impression that the person is getting a more valuable item, either because we inflate the advertising or because we give the impression that this isn't normally the price, but I'm doing it just for you. It's a bargain. I paid much more for this. I'm taking a loss. All those things, which even though it may result in him buying something at its actual value, but it creates the impression that he's getting a better deal than he really is. So that is at least Gnevis Das. Now the question is here, is it maybe even more? If I'm convincing somebody to pay a totally artificial price for something, is that maybe even Gnevis Mammon? Because basically, if the price is set based on this process, and this process is false, I'm not sure that's not even monetary theft. Hi.
Hi.
do you think it would be either Ganim as Das or Ganim as Mamluk if you were at an auction and you raised the price by bidding with no intention to buy it, just because you know the guy's ability, or he's going to buy it no matter what, but you just keep going up to keep him going? Not necessarily.
What, if you're not competing, actually?
Well, technically you are. You'll be held to a standard.
So what's the problem? The problem is are you actually thinking of buying it?
Here it's like this. Okay, you can, on eBay, you can bid on an item, and if you back out, so the guy with the next highest bid gets it.
Mm-hmm.
So you bid 100, 120, 130, you go 140, you back out after the auction, it alerts him, okay, you actually won at 130. That guy couldn't afford it. So what if you go, and you bid on your own item, and then you just back out, but you got the price to jump up higher.
Yeah, that's the same issue. If you're doing it yourself, that's even worse. But the same kind of thing, just possible to do it yourself because you're on the internet. But yeah, that's essentially falsely creating impression that it's worth something that it isn't.
But he's saying, okay, so I'm willing to buy it, even if it doesn't matter.
He's willing to buy it partially because he thinks it's worth that much because he sees what other people have bid for it.
Or he's committed. Maybe I really want this. Okay, I'm going to go up to 200. At that point, I'll stop. But. No matter what, up to then, he commits and said, I'll spend up to $200.
So he wouldn't spend that $200 unless you bid it up to
$200. Right.
He would have, if you wasn't...
Especially when you talk about, Amazon, or you talk about the eBay, or really in most any auction, you have a reserve price, right? So you should start at the fair price. So if he's willing to pay the fair price for it, so then that's what you should start the price at. If the only reason he's willing to pay that price is because he feels that it must be worth more than he thought because other people have been competing for it, so he's essentially been deceived. So there's definitely a component of Nevis Das. I'm not even sure it's not even straight out theft. Because here you're essentially putting a false price on something. Right, if I sell you a car that's worth $1,000 and I tell you it's worth $5,000 and I sell it to you for $1,000, it's Nevis Das. If I sell it to you for $5,000, then it's really fraud. Or nah, right? Essentially, like we spoke about the first time. So maybe it's onah, essentially. Or, you know, it's not real onah because you don't have necessarily a market price, but it's something akin to that. It's some type of fraud. Mm-hmm. So there was an auction for comments, so who's willing to pay the most to get called on first?
So,
well, who's the end of it? You want me to go first? Sorry.
Let's say you either work at a company or you're involved you're working with somebody and they tell you that you're going to be a consultant for X amount of money per month.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out later that they're only allowed to employ you for 6 months, but they don't tell you that. Is that a case where
Yeah, well, first of all, it's deceptive on a couple levels, theoretically. You know, the question is, so what's going to happen is, first of all, if that means that after 6 months they're going to stop doing it, but they enticed you to take it in the first place because you thought it would last longer, so then you're being misled from that perspective. If they plan on doing it anyway against the law, and you're a law-abiding person, you don't want to be a part of that. So they're being misled that way.
Wouldn't you also be sort of liable for not finding out all the information going into it?
And the question is how reasonable it is for you to be able to figure it out. You know, is it something that the average person knows? Is that do you have a reasonable basis to assume we've been presented with all the relevant information?
Well, wouldn't the company have an achrayus to tell?
They presumably would. That's presumably their responsibility, yeah. If they're doing something which, especially more so in the first case, if they're going to do something, if they're going to promise something which they're not really going to do, or give the impression they're going to do something, but they're not really going to do it because it's against the law, you know, a little more so. Okay, but the auction question, yes, Hassan.
I heard of a similar shot. I don't think it's, I can't imagine being a problem in this last problem, though, where two people are going into an auction and they both want to buy the item, so they can't. That maybe it isn't. I don't know which problem would be, but I've heard that they should talk to each other about how much the other one's willing to pay, because only one one's going to win it at that price. So instead of driving it up to 150, he says you're only willing to go to 120. He goes, yeah, well, it's okay. So like I was willing to go higher. So then the other guy knows to drop out because instead of causing the other guy to pay more money by keeping the bid going. So what's the issue there? I mean, I've heard that as a Shiloh before. With two Jewish people going into an auction for something that they should discuss with, that perhaps they should discuss with each other beforehand, what's the most other one's willing to pay?
Right. I mean, the question was, are you obligated to compete against each other just to drive up the price for the other guy? And what if you didn't participate in the first place?
Well, they both have sincere intentions to buy it, but...
Right, so I'm saying, so if you're not going to bother because I know that you're going to dwarf me.
Right.
So it's hard to say he's not entitled to find out that information himself beforehand. It's part of his own background into his purchase. Something to think about, but it's hard to say that that's necessarily a problem. I mean, in theory, if you want to say the seller has the right to the highest price based on how they fight it out, and now you're depriving him of that right, mm-hmm. You know, theoretically, you're kind of depriving the seller of his full purchase, of his full selling price, except that it's hard to imagine that you're obligated to drive it up by fighting with someone else.
Right.
It's certainly the other way to artificially drive it up.
Right, but here isn't as artificial.
Right, no, here's not artificial at all. He's saying he's going to step out, he's not going to partake in the process, which would otherwise push it up.
The two parties are friends. Right. He says, I'm not willing to pay 120. He goes, he's always willing to pay 150, so he goes, they go into lockdown.
So if they choose to opt out, So theoretically, the victim here is the seller, because the seller is not getting the full price that he would have gotten had they actually duked it out. The question is, are they obligated to provide that for him? Are they obligated to...
Right. Or is there a problem if they didn't discuss that with each other? Meaning the other guy will end up paying more when it's obvious one of them will win it.
How does that work? If they didn't discuss it, then how does it work?
Then, it would have gone up to, 130, whereas opposed to if they discussed beforehand, and it's obvious...
Right, so what's their second scenario? What's the second scenario where they don't discuss it?
Yeah, where they don't discuss it, and it's driven up. So what's the problem with that?
If they don't discuss it, it's driven up. That's the way it works. So the way it works is that everyone expresses what they're willing to pay for it.
And is there a problem with that?
Is there a problem with a normal auction?
Yeah.
No, that's the way the auctions work in general, that everyone expresses what they're willing to pay, and the market creates itself because people are willing to pay more because there's more competition for it. In general, auction is really a market in microcosm, right? That every item in the world, its price is set based on supply and demand. So there's X amount of items in the world, and there are Y amount of people who want it, and therefore those factors come together and determine how much it costs. So here you have an auction, you have this one item, and you have however many people in the room want it and how much they want it. So essentially that is what creates the price. But if they're doing it artificially, it's not really what they want, then you have deception, probably monetary deception also. But if they're choosing not to partake in the process, it's hard to say that anyone is doing anything wrong on that, even though it results in the seller not getting the full price he could have gotten otherwise, but it's hard to say they're obligated to provide that by creating the demand. Yosef?
So you started with the question of is it Gnevas Das or Gnevas Mammon, right? And that's
right.
So what is the conclusion?
I'm not sure. I think there might be Gnevas Mammon. Essentially, you're inflicting a false price on this guy. In terms of it technically to be Ona, it's something akin to Ona. In terms of it technically to be Ona, you might need to have a market price. And here, you're creating the market within this room. So is it going to be technically Ona? You have to figure out. But it's certainly in spirit akin to Ona. If you're essentially creating a false price and making him pay the false price, probably should be more than that. Hi.
Would he have to, if it is Gazelle, would he have to pay back everything or just like the amount that...
Right, so that gets back to the whole Ona question. So if the item's really not worth what the... if we use the Ona model... If it's completely out of whack, the whole sale is negated. And if it's closer to the right price within a sixth, if it's exactly a sixth, so then the extra goes back. So here it's harder to figure out exactly what should be. But theoretically, it could be the whole sale was under false pretenses. something to think about. Hi.
So, related to auctions, very often you have stores like the whole, or industries, the whole thing thrives on bargaining. So when people come in and make statements about what prices they're willing to pay or they're willing to charge, is that going to be asked? Because, I mean, I think everyone knows that's not what they mean. You know, you walk into the shop and you ask how much is something. If I can name a thousand, this guy tells you 50 shekels, but you know that the going price, and he knows you know the going price is like 30. But you know, he wants you to, he's supposed to say 50, you're supposed to say 10, and you'll 20.
Yeah, that's a tricky discussion. There was a lot to say about that in general.
Especially given that there are a few clueless people who will say 50, okay, here's 50.
Right, and then if that's essentially the rate in this, to a certain extent, it's a little bit of a complex market. Maybe we'll come back to the subject a little bit, because the market probably survives on some mixture of dealing with people of different willingnesses to pay. So they set their rates at the maximum anybody was willing to pay, and the hopes, legitimately, lay under the hopes that it's actually worth that much on some scale. And then by doing business with a whole mixture of people, and some people are willing to pay less, and they'll sell more items that way to those people, somehow they're able to do business. They're able to.
Someone says, like, you know, you hear it all the time, I won't go a shack below 40. And 5 minutes later, you walk out of the store having bought it for 30. So it's actually a task, but it's almost lying, but.
Right, that's a good question. Whether or not there is a lot, Rabbi Levine has written a lot about that. Maybe we'll come in. I want to talk about negotiating at some point. We'll get into that a little bit more. It's not necessarily always the case that he's lying. You know, it could be that that's really what he feels, and then he just realizes once he's confronted with actually not getting the item that he is willing to go above or below whichever party it is. So it's not necessarily untrue when he says it. Now, to the extent that it may be untrue, that's a little bit of a more complicated discussion, so we'll get to negotiating, we'll come back to that. I think it was Chesky up first?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I think there's like a part of the Dharma which discusses about like that concept that we consider it a...
Right, about the...
If you swear, oh, I won't go less than 4, and he says, I won't go less than 2, then we understand that they won't be 3. So I'd say similarly, in some of these cases where I've seen that whenever we determine what people really know what this market price is, so even when the guy's just saying it, he's just saying it, and he really means less than he's...
Right, that Gemara itself opens up a lot of questions as to when it's talking about just the Nedarim component and when it's talking about what's permitted for other reasons. You know, the Mishnah there is talking about which Nedarim are considered to be undermined at their very inception, so it may just be stating that the Neder itself is not necessarily binding as a Neder, and then it opens up a whole discussion whether it's permissible for other reasons.
Right. Saying, like, you see that people don't, like, when they say even 4 in the market context, they're not necessarily serious about that. They might be less, and we accept that
as well. Alright, so let's come back to that point in terms of negotiating. So, Song?
Also, what Avi's question was, isn't also if something's accepted practice, meaning within the world, then of how business is done? There's a Gemara that says, they don't know what to do, how business is done in certain cases. It says, book causes the shuba, and then they go and they based off that, they determine halacha. So even if we think that halacha might not be a certain way, but we see that this is accepted, and everyone understands that this is how business is done, and there's really no, there's no,
there's no deception.
There's no deception.
Sometimes,
it's understood that,
sometimes that's true. So that's part we'll have to get that. Sometimes that's true, and sometimes not true. We'll have to... The question is that there's no deception involved,
that the guy says, yeah, I'm not going
to... Sometimes, or sometimes it's that there's deception involved and they're able to deceive some of the people so they make their profit off of that. So you have to figure out which one it is. Mm-hmm. Is that they're deceiving the other people, or that they're really giving everyone somewhat of a fair price, so some people get a better price, and then eventually the whole business evens out.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about that. Hi.
When you're selling something, what's the line between trying to, you don't want to make it look bad, so you try to, shine it up whenever, make it look nice.
So that's one of the major Gnevis Das questions. So that's, let's talk about that in a second. I just want to say one more point about the auction thing, and then we'll come right back to that. So in terms of the auction thing, it's also interesting. The Chida was a great Sfari Talmud Chacham, wrote many, many Sfarim. He has in his Tshuvas, he has a case... A discussion about sometimes you have in shuls, they have auctions for kibbutim, say for aliyahs. So let's say you want to use that same kind of shtick in order to drive up the price of the aliyah.
Well, that's a mitzvah.
us. So the question is, justifies? Can you have a das justified for a mitzvah? So pashtus not. That's one problem. Is that the same way you can't steal for a mitzvah, you can't cheat people out of their auction money for a mitzvah either. And there's an additional component here. There's an additional issue in that, in doing so, the person who you're in cahoots with, so he's doing other Gnevas Dasas, because while he's bidding on the Aliyah, so let's say I'm going to sell the Aliyah and I'm going to have somebody working with me to drive the price up. So the whole shul sees this guy bidding on the Aliyah, they think he's willing to pay that much for this mitzvah. So he's getting people's esteem, to whatever extent people actually respect him for that, but he's getting people's esteem based on something that's not really true. He doesn't really have any intention to pay this for the mitzvah. So that's also a problem. And so there's Gnevas Das going on there also. So there's a couple levels of Gnevas Das. That was what was pointed out by the Chidah in that case. So in terms of a Yonatan's case, so that's a sugya in the Gemara in the end of Hazav, which sounds like it's a Gnevas Das consideration theoretically. So let's say if you're selling something and you have an old item and you want to paint it and spruce it up in a way so that it looks new. So that is a problem theoretically of Gnevas Das also. If it's really going to be so much of a makeover that it looks like a completely different item, it's worth something fundamentally different, so then you could have a Mekach Tov situation also. But if, let's say, you're not going to be charging so much of a different price, but you're going to create the impression the person's getting a better deal because they think they're buying something new when it's really old, so that's a problem. That's going to be a Gnevas Das problem. Hi.
Isn't it assumed that the person is going to do this? So, for instance,
yes and no.
They're selling. It's kind of like everyone knows.
Yes.
Don't expect to see peel and paint. Everyone knows paint your house before you sell it.
Right. So that I was about to discuss, that the idea that you want to put the best face forward, the idea that you're going to give a new coat of paint and that you're going to clean up and you're going to make everything presented in the best light possible, that is accepted. That is the practice. The question is, when it crosses the line into trying to pass off something that's old as actually new through the paint job, that's where you get into a problem. If it's just presenting things in the best possible light, making it look as nice as possible within its specific category, so it looks like an old house that's very well maintained and that's quite nice even though it's old, as opposed to looking like a house that was built yesterday and being presented as brand new.
Short of lying, what
would cause that? You could intentionally present something in such a way so that it looks like it's different than it is. You could intentionally paint something in a way that it looks falsely new.
Even with that price change?
Yeah, if you do with a price change, then it could potentially be oh no. You know, if you're really creating the value difference, so then you could have real problems. It's also, however, recognized that certain improvements that you do raise the value of something, even though it doesn't cost you that much to do the improvement. So that's also legitimate. You know, so if you, that's, you know, you flip a house or whatever, you do something to a house where you put in the expense and now you're able to sell it for more, so essentially you're going to get back more than you just put into it. So if you're about to sell your house and you paint it, then now it just is a nicer looking house and you're able to sell it for more because it's a painted house, even though the increase in value is more than the money you spent on the paint, that's legitimate. It just becomes a question when it actually creates a false impression. And then that theoretically could also create a problem if somebody is doing that to themselves also, if somebody is misrepresenting themselves on the job market. Let's say if they want to dye their hair to look younger than they are, and the employer specifically wants to hire younger people. So that could be a problem as well. There are all kinds of nuances, setting aside the question of whether or not it's permissible for men to dye their hair, which involves other considerations in halacha, but just in terms of potentially deceiving the employer, then if the employer thinks he's getting somebody younger and the job needs a younger person, and you're going to create the impression that you're younger than you are, So then that theoretically create a problem. Now, alternatively, if somebody is prematurely gray and he really is younger and he wants to look his actual age and he looks older than he really is, that could be a different story. That's also a discussion. All comes out of the Gemara in Bava Metzia and Daf Samach, in the very end of Hazav. So this is the very end of the Onoah parak. So you see where the topic kind of segues one to the other. So one of the things the Mishnah mentioned, one of the things that comes up in the Gemara over there, is let's say you're selling meat, and you could soak the meat in such a way that it's going to be kind of cleaned off, it's going to look plumper than it is. It's going to look unusually plump. Or you could actually pump it up with air so it'll look bigger. So both of those, the Gemara says not to do. But it's interesting, there is a machlokas about if it's the minig, let's say the custom is that everyone sells meat this way, that it's presented this way as a basic principle of practice. So then the Sma, on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, the Sma says that's legitimate, that everyone understands that that's the way it's presented, and they're not deceived by it. And others disagreed. Divrei Malkiel, later Poskim, disagreed. But there are some contemporary authors, there's a great sefer on Mamonis Issues by Rav Yaakov Yeshaya Beloy, who just passed away a few weeks ago, a sefer called Pisrei Choshen. So he suggests a difference between the two cases over there in the Gemara, that it's one thing if you are soaking it so it will look bigger. But to pump it up, that, even if the minig is to pump it up, that's not acceptable. And what it seems to be, what he's saying is that if it's merely a gnevus das issue, you'll pay the same price, but it looks like you're getting a little bit of a better product. So then the minig could perhaps, at least according to some, make it okay. That if this is the way it's always presented, so then that's legitimate. But if it's a real onah question, you're actually going to give somebody the impression they're getting more material value than they're actually paying for, or then you know, they'll pay for more material value than they're actually getting, rather. So then that's not going to be justifiable, even if the minig is to do that. You follow the distinction?
Liquid is considered.
So the point is that if everyone presents it this way, so it looks like you're getting a better deal, but this is the way that everyone who purchases understands things are presented, so that's the minig. So then the minig is enough to offset the idea that somebody might think he's getting a little bit of a better deal, though not everyone agreed with that, but that was the Sma's position. But if it's not just that he thinks he's getting a better deal, you're actually creating the impression he's getting more product than he's actually getting by putting air in to make the item bigger, so people think there's more there. So then that's actual oh no, they're really paying for something they're not getting. So that he thought that the minig is not enough to justify. Another aspect that's especially important to mention in a classroom setting is, as Moshe Feinstein and others have pointed out, so cheating on tests is also a violation, at least, of Gnevas Das, and potentially of Gnevas Mammon as well. So why is it at least Gnevas Das? That we understand, right? The idea is you're essentially trying to create the impression that you know more, or you studied harder, or you're more accomplished in this area than you actually are. So that's, at least at the offset, That's already a Gnevas Das issue. It potentially could be a Gnevas Mammon issue as well, because people get jobs based on their rankings in classes, based on their grade point averages and the like. So if you're going to compete with someone else for a job based on a artificially inflated grade, so then you could theoretically be taking somebody else's job or somebody else's spot in the class, which is worth money, or taking money from an employer who wouldn't give it to you if he knew what your actual grades were. So theoretically, you could actually get into monetary issues. That is the reason, by the way. I remember I was on a committee many years ago. I don't know how it actually ended up. So Yeshiva University policy. What does it actually say? You know that cheating is prohibited, but they also, at least initially, and we're going to make part of the policy, maybe that is part of the policy, that you're obligated to report if you see your friend cheating, which is a much bigger burden to put on somebody. It's one thing to say you can't cheat. It gets much more difficult for people to turn in others who are cheating. But the premise is that it's essentially a reflection of Lo Samar al Dam Riecha, that if you see somebody else picking somebody's pocket, if I were to see you're stealing that guy's wallet, so I have to defend his wallet, I have to tell him that he's being robbed. So too, if the assumption here is that there is some amount of Gnevus Mammon, that if you're cheating, you're essentially taking somebody else's slot in the job market or wherever else, so then in order to defend others, you have to rectify the situation. So that's the premise of the policy, that not only could you not cheat, but you also could not stand by when somebody else cheats and you know about it. Hi.
In terms of the potential job that you're going to get, why is it considered, it's only potential gain, so why is it considered that you're stealing from someone?
It's not considered actionable in the sense that of Nezikin, that they can't necessarily take you to Bezdin and recover the losses. But in general, we talk about Nezikin and damages. So you have a principle that Grama b'Nezikin is Pater, that if I don't damage your stuff directly, but I do something to cause you a loss, so then I'm exempt in Bezdin. But that only means that I can't be sued. You can't recover damages, but it's still not permissible to do. It's still some type of theft. So, and beforehand, another party has the ability and the responsibility to stop it. Hi.
Would that spur also apply to someone who already has a job set in place for him, and he's just cheating on tests at the end of his college career because...
Yeah, it's at least Gnevus Das. You know, whether it's always Gnevus Mammon might involve sometimes a little bit of a stretch. It's potentially Gnevus Mammon, but it's at least Gnevus Das, because if you're creating a false impression that you're more prepared or more knowledgeable than you are, so then you're at least doing it for some reason. Somebody's going to see this grade, so there's somebody who you're deceiving. Then will it actually lead to a monetary issue? It could be as well. It's hard to draw the line when it will and when it won't. Very often it may, and some, I'm sure you can come up with examples where it won't. So then at least it's Gnevus Das. Hi.
If it is Gnevus Mammon, can't you say that every dollar, like throughout your entire life, all the money that you make is Gnevus?
Yeah, it's a hard call, right?
It's not that all the money you make, but every single.
Right. So that it would seem to have pretty sweeping consequences.
Right.
So you know, it's hard to say that because you know eventually things kind of even out, and essentially, so your employer is still paying you for work you're actually doing.
But you wouldn't have had that job.
Right. So therefore, there was some level of Gnevus. You're definitely not earning every cent that you're getting.
Right.
But ultimately, it's hard to call every cent a function of that Gnevus, you know, and say that you'd have to be a pretty impressive ganav to be able to have a lifelong parnasa based on that one deception. But there's a certain percentage of it that's coming you weren't entitled to. And the depriving that you have, the fact you deprive somebody else of the job, so again, it's like Yonatan was saying, we don't see that as actual stolen funds that can be recovered, but it was wrong to do. It's essentially...
scary in terms of the fact that you can't like if you steal from someone you can either you know do teshuva or pay him back or you know somehow like
how do you pay back the employer
for that?
Right, it is hard to rectify. Right,
it's
very, yeah, it's a good question. How you? I mean, you could eventually right.
You don't know who you hurt.
Yeah, it's, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's why the Gemara says that Kasha Onshin Shalmidos Yosha Mishal Arayas, the Gemara in Yavamis, which I think many people misunderstand what it's getting at, but the Gemara says that something is worse than Arayas. So I think people think the Gemara might mean Midos in terms of being nice to people, but in other words, that it's worse to be mean than to sin in Arayas. But that's not what the Gemara really is talking about. The Gemara means midos in the sense of midos and mishkalos, that the Torah prohibits having false measurements and false weights because you end up deceiving people, you end up overcharging people, And that has an aspect of it that's more severe than sinning in the area of Arayas. Because if you sin in the area of Arayas, you could do tshuva. If you steal from the public, it's very hard to do tshuva. There are ways to still atone, but it's very hard to really fix the problem. You created a mass societal issue, and it's not something that you can really find the victims and actually pay them back. It's an interesting question in general, the assumption that in order to do tshuva, this is a question for a different time, but it's just an interesting theoretical question. In order to do tshuva for stealing, so you have to return the money. So you can make a chakira, why is it that you have to return the money? Is it because the avera isn't fixed unless you return the money, and therefore you can't do tshuva without the avera being fixed? Or should you say, no, the avera really could be fixed by itself. It's just not called tshuva if you continue to benefit and enjoy the avera. So a person can't say, I stole something, but I did tshuva and I'm keeping it, because if you really did tshuva, then you'd give it back. You wouldn't continue to benefit from it. So the fact that you haven't given back the item is something that undermines the tshuva. But if it's impossible to give it back, if whatever circumstances are that you just simply don't have the ability to fix it, so then maybe that wouldn't be the case. So it's a big difference between the two. So it's a little bit of a tricky question. There are proofs you can bring from the Gemaras that go in either direction if you wanted to really go through it. It's a tricky thing. It's a good thing to stay away from the Ganevas to begin with, because it's not always so easy to fix. Okay, what other practical Ganevas Das issues could come up? Again, some of the examples in the Gemara. So one example the Gemara gives is that the Gemara specifically phrases it itself in a certain way, which is probably important, says that you shouldn't, let's say, pressure someone or prevail upon someone to come to your party or to come to your house when you know that he can't come. Why is that? Because he gets the impression that you're ready to lay out an expense for him, you're ready to host him at your party. And really, it's easy credit for you because you know he's not going to come. So you can give him the impression that you're ready to do this, and it's really cheap because he's not actually going to make you spend the money, and you know that. Yes?
So people have simchas all the time and have international family, whether it's Israel or vice versa, and whether or not you send them an invitation or you call them and invite them, you know they're not going to come, but people do that anyway.
Yeah, so I don't think that's really a problem. There are those who have such a chumrah that they don't send invitations to even close family members who are out of the country and who they know are not going to come. But the poskim, for the most part, don't think that's a problem. First of all, they note that the language of the Gemara isn't that you shouldn't invite someone, but that it's specifically yisarhev, that you're really going to, oh, please come, prevail upon the person. And that the general attitude poskim have taken is that, separate from the fact that you never know who may actually decide to show up, but if you really have a scenario, you really know the guy's not going to come, still there is a certain amount of cover to that person that's involved in the invitation. And therefore, to invite someone normally, I mean, in a way that's moderate, you send the invitation, so then the general attitude post can take is that's not called game of stats. It's that you really push the guy, and you know there's no chance he's coming, but you want to get the credit that as if you're willing to pay for him, and you're really pushing the point in order to get this credit, that's where you have a Ganevas Das problem. It's also worth pointing out that it's really kind of nuanced when it's actually Ganevas Das, or when it's really the full-fledged Ganevas Das. Because we also saw, we think we discussed last week, that another exception to the Ganevas Das principle that some poskim invoke, it sounds like this from the Gemara that this exists, is that maybe I didn't do something on behalf of this guy, but I would have. Right, we gave the example last week, you know, you went to the hospital to visit someone else and you didn't know this guy was there and he thinks you came for him. So what if I didn't come for him, but I would have? If I had known he was there, I would have come even if I didn't have any other person to visit in the hospital. So then that's invoked by some poskim as a legitimate thing to do. So one could even make the case that even if I ask the guy to come four or five times, I beg him to come. So even if I know he's not going to come, but if the fact is I still would really be willing to pay for him and be happy to pay for him if he did come, so you can make an argument that's still not Gnevus Das. So presumably for this to be a full-fledged, real Gnevus Das, it's where really you don't want to pay at all. And the only reason you're asking and pushing this guy is because you know there's no chance he's going to come. So you can take advantage of the fact that he's not going to come to score points that he thinks you're willing to pay for his seat. So then that's when it's full-fledged Gnevus Das. When does it seem to not be Gnevus Das at all? A one normal invitation, even if he's very unlikely to come. And you could argue that maybe in the middle, even if you know he's really not going to come, but you want to really push it because you would still be happy to pay for him if he did come. So strictly speaking, that middle case is probably not Gnevus Das either, although that gets closer to what the Gemara describes. But if it's just one normal invitation, you send an invitation to the guy in Israel to come to your bar mitzvah in New York, so you know that he's not going to come, but he's a family member who's going to be happy to be thought of. So, and it took a, you know, you had to pay for a stamp. That's not nothing but money either. You know, at least you had to invest something to invite him, so, or even a phone call, even just the fact that you think it's somebody, that's already something. So if that's all you're accomplishing, so then that's reasonable. But the language that comes out from the Gemara and that Poskim have focused on is that if you're going to really make a whole production out of it, then that's where you potentially enter into a problem. Hi.
And isn't the issue the fact that you're getting brownie points, like they think that... You know,
correct. So that the annual brownie points...
Basically understood at this point that you invite all of your family, you know, it's understood that they understand they're not flying in, and they understand that you know they're not flying.
You're saying why it should be you're saying why it should be mutter.
No. Why should it be us or me?
Right. You're saying the reason why it should be mutter. Yes, correct. Right. So that is basically that's the attitude most Poskim have taken. Even though, like I said, I have met people who will not send an invitation out of the country, no matter what. I think that's a little bit. That could be awesome. But what you're saying is basically what Poskim have said, that it's not considered to be an attempt to get false goodwill if you're inviting a family member or somebody who would expect to be on the list and they happen not to be technically available to come. Then it's generally agreed that that's not what the Gemara is talking about, and that the language of the Gemara is referring to somebody specifically who you're trying to exploit the fact that he can't come. And therefore, it's harmless for you to be as magnanimous as possible because you know he can't take you up on it. Hi.
If you pressure someone, could that also be an honest alarm? Could you cause them stress?
It depends what kind of stress, you know, theoretically. Hopefully, when people do this, it's really for the mutual benefit. They should feel wanted and they want the person really to be at his simcha. And,
grandparent lives out of the country, something they can't travel, and they keep on telling them about some film, like they're going to be very stressed that they can't come.
They might be stressed, but they may be more stressed to feel like they're not wanted there in the first place. So that's a reasonable evaluation to make, that they'd rather hear that you really want them there and that you're really going to miss them than feel pressured about coming. Okay, so that's another case that Gemara talks about. And just to mention as one last point, you know, the Gemara also does talk about in general as an example of Gnevus Das, on the one hand creating the impression that you're doing a favor for someone when really you aren't. And that there seems to also be an exception, also based on the Gemara, that if the person draws this conclusion on his own, as we discussed a little bit last week, so then that's his mistake, and it's not necessarily your problem. So there are Gemaras that sound like that, and there are Gemaras that sound differently. So the post can try to figure out how exactly you draw the line. Some discuss, like Rabbi Levine talks about in his books, about a reasonable man standard, that if a reasonable man would think you're doing this for other reasons, and the unreasonable person decides on his own that you're doing it for him, so then that's not your problem. But if any reasonable person would think you're doing it for them, so then that obligates you to disclose. Others distinguish between where you're doing something and they mistakenly think you're doing it for them, and that's not your problem, with cases where they mistakenly think you're actually doing something different than what you're doing. And that maybe is your problem, if you're giving the impression you're doing something different, other than the first case where you are actually coming to the hospital. They decided on their own you're coming for you. that's they're coming for them, that's where maybe you have more of a problem. So there are various suggestions in post-com and try to figure out what the distinction is, but theoretically you have such an idea that if a person fools himself, that's not your problem, and if you try to create the false impression or you do something that any reasonable person would interpret differently, so that's where it's your problem. As we mentioned also last week, that if in such a case, it would often still be advisable in terms of yashrus for you to come clean anyway, except that sometimes that comes at other costs, and sometimes that'll end up insulting the person. And it's not always worth doing, or it's not always reasonable. Hi.
What's the rule regarding resumes? You know, everyone kind of puts a word or two, which kind of pops up their involvement in certain organizations or something, that makes it seem like they took on more responsibility than they actually had, even though the word technically fits the description of what they did. But the resumes always are about pumping yourself up to look more than.
It gets the same distinction we mentioned before, that if you're actually creating a false impression, actually painting a picture that's not really true, so then that is.
I mean, it's
possibly
up to their interpretation to the mistake.
So then the question is, how much is it a reasonable interpretation, or how much is it really an attempt to present something as more than it was? Again, the assumption always is that people will put their best foot forward. Right? That doesn't necessarily mean that they'll say something that's deceptive. If something really creates a false impression and really paints a picture in the reader's eyes of something that's not true, so then that should be Gnevas Das, and theoretically getting a job could also, like cheating on a test, even be something along the lines of Gnevas Mamon. And also, just in terms of legally and the business world, is a terrible idea. You know, if somebody misrepresents something on a resume, you know, really their career is really over. But in terms of the normal presentation of things, so yeah, everyone expects that you will present something in the best possible light within the range of what's honest. But if it's actually misrepresentational, if it actually creates the impression in the reader that something is there that isn't, and then it's at least a Gnevas Das problem. Okay, so maybe we'll try to start the topic of Ribbis a little bit. Just want to mention before leaving Gnevas Das that the word, if before you heard this whole sugya, you might say, oh, what does Gnevas Das mean? Okay, literally stealing information. So what about industrial espionage? Or what about intellectual property misappropriation? So that also sometimes has been termed Gnevas Das in other contexts. God willing, we'll get to that in a different subject heading. So yes, Gnevas Das is sometimes used also to address that. But just in terms of this setting, if you appropriate somebody else's intellectual property and pass it off as your own, so then let's say two models, for example. So we're not talking about right now. Let's say you write a book and I decide to publish it under your name and sell it myself. So that could be intellectual property problems, that it's your right to own the property and to profit off it. And I'm profiting off it, so that's a problem. What problem, we'll talk about in a separate conversation. There are some who call that Gnevas Das, because you're literally taking their das, their intellectual output, and literally stealing it, so to speak. But that's clearly a different usage than what we've been talking about here. Although, if you pass it off as your own, if you put your own name on the book, so then it's Gnevas Das in this sense, because you're creating the impression that you authored this book, or you're capable of authoring this book, and that's false goodwill. You're impressing people falsely, and that's going to be, in that case, both types of Gnevas Das. So, in other words, one kind of Gnevas Das we're talking about here, another type we'll talk about in the future, but important just to be aware of the different categories. All right, so let's talk about Ribbis a little bit. So, Ribbis as a subject, it's a very, very hard subject. We'll have to see how much time we can give to it. It's hard because it has a lot of the details, and the details are very complicated, and you could easily spend the whole year learning it. But it's also hard just conceptually to understand why it's a problem and how exactly it plays out in a halachic sense. But just first off, what is Ribbis? Sorry?
Interest.
Okay, so we normally would translate Ribbis as interest. It's interesting, the Torah uses a different word for Ribbis. What word does the Torah use? So this appears in Parshas Mishpatim and in Parshas Behar and Parshas Kiseitse, the Torah talks about Neshech and Tarbis, which are two words which both refer to interest. They have different connotations, and it might be somewhat instructive. Neshech literally means to take a bite out of someone. You're biting into somebody, and that's the impression you get from that kind of usage. And tarbis is a more neutral kind of meaning. It means a increase. And in Talmudic usage and in contemporary usage, so we use the term ribis. And what it officially refers to, the Gemara has in the beginning of the fifth parak of Bava Metzia, Rav Nachman states that the principle of ribis, klola de ribisa, is kol ogre naterle, that any time somebody gets paid for waiting for his money, that's ribis. So I give you $100 today, you'll give it back to me in a week or in a month or in a year, and you'll pay more because I waited that time. That's called agar naterle, the reward you get for waiting, and that's called ribis. And strictly speaking, ribis applies to any consumable item. So whether it's money or whether it is a commodity. But if it's something that you use up and give me a different one, then it's subject to the rules of ribis. So the Gemara has an expression, for example, when it comes to a loan, that milva lehotza nitna, which means that if I lend you $10, I lend you a $10 bill, so I understand that you're not going to give me back that $10 bill. That's not the point. Then what would you be accomplishing? You're going to spend those $10, and eventually you'll pay me back a different $10 bill, or 10 singles, or 40 quarters, whatever it is, you'll give me back something different. So that's the definition of halva in halacha. That's called a monetary loan. So if I do that with money or commodities, if I lend you some pretzels and you're going to give me back pretzels, but you're giving me back different pretzels because you ate the first set of pretzels, so that's comparable. Anything in that category where you consume what I'm giving you, and you give me back a different thing of the same value, that's a halva, and if it's more, that's where you get into ribis. But it does not apply to what's known in halacha as she'ela. In English, it's hard, because in English, we don't really have terms to distinguish between the two, so you call them both a loan. But in Hebrew, it's called a halva versus a she'ela. So if I lend you my car, and you give me back a car, the same car, so then that's called she'ela. That's not called halva, and that's not subject to the halachas of ribis. So that's the basic definition. And the concept is difficult because from a moral perspective, there are a lot of questions you could ask about the prohibition of ribis. I could paint you a picture where you could see morally ribis as something very bad. Now, let's say there's an elderly widow who can't pay her rent, and she asks me for help in borrowing money to pay the rent. And I say, sure, I'll lend you the money. And I charge a high rate of interest. And she can't afford the interest. So it comes next month, she owes me even more money because she can't afford the interest for more. And I say, okay, I'll give you even more, but now you're going to pay me more interest. Until I'm essentially exploiting her and causing her tremendous suffering because she can't afford to pay all this, but she has no choice because she's going to get thrown out of her apartment. So you could paint a picture where the taking of interest is a moral offense. But that's not the only kind of interest that we're talking about. That's the problem. So that kind of interest you'd call nowadays usury. Usury is a word which in earlier settings was used to mean interest, but contemporary dictionaries call usury archaic in that sense. And that the usage of the word usury today is also known as predatory lending. That if you lend in such a way that you're basically preying on the borrower, so you're going to take advantage of their needs and exploit them so they have to pay you a lot of return that they maybe can afford or can't afford, but they're only doing it because they have to, and you're exploiting that. All right, you could see that as a moral offense. What's a little bit harder to understand about the halachic principle is that it doesn't only apply in that setting. Right, that's the kind of setting, like we said, by the way, which you could understand the Torah using the word neshach. Right, you're biting into the person. You're essentially, and the Sefer Achinuch actually emphasizes that, that you're going to take the person for everything he has, because at the moment he was vulnerable, he needed a loan right now, so he had to make a commitment that he can't really handle, so you're essentially biting into the person, taking away everything he has. So that's consistent with the usage of the word neshach in the Torah. You're biting into someone. Hi.
I mean, I thought it was more the way I had understood the biting thing, was that since he does something that's small that people don't like recognize. So it's like closer to Gnevus Das, more than the fact that, like, oh, you're doing something which is intentionally harmful and exploiting them and then causing pain. So, like, it doesn't have to be a widow or whatever, but even if you're doing it to a rich businessman who can afford it, point is he won't recognize what you've done to him by making a 1% interest rate, and you're going to end up causing him a loss. So that principle is...
So that's a fair interpretation. Except the Sefer Achinuch says it this way, that it means that you're biting into the person. The problem is, you see, it still needs more of a definition, because what you've said so far, you're assuming that that's a loss, that it's not reasonable for him to pay this 1%. And one could argue that it's totally reasonable, and that all legitimate businesses function today with, and all banks for sure, function today with some minimal rate of interest. And the perception, at least of the modern business world, is that it is completely reasonable and people happily pay it because that's what they're able to, what makes them able to do business. So you have to, if that's true, what you said, we have to define this a little bit more. Why should that be a problem? So one question that we have to figure out is, why is it that the Torah doesn't only prohibit the picture that we painted with the old widow, but any amount of interest is prohibited? And we'll also see, we'll talk about some of the models. Some are very sweeping and more extreme than you'd imagine, that you find a really very significant scope to this prohibition, any type of increase at all being covered. So why is that such an issue? Why do we believe so fundamentally that any amount of increase on the original loan is a problem? Sorry, you had a question?
No.
That's one question you might want to try to figure out. Second thing that's a little bit surprising is, if the whole idea is that you're victimizing somebody by taking this interest from him, so let's say you want to compare it to theft for a moment. So if I, Yonatan, go up to you with a gun and I say, your money or your life, and I take your money, so two things you can assume from that model. First of all, I'm the criminal, you're the victim. Second of all, if we change the scenario that I don't take a gun to you at all, but you come up to me and say, hi, here's some money, happy perm, or whatever it is, then there's no crime at all. However, in the context of ribis, that breaks down, because I charge you interest, so neither of those statements are true. First of all, it's not that I'm the criminal and you're the victim, but in the eyes of halacha, we're both in trouble. We both committed an avera. I for collecting the interest and you for paying the interest. And if you come and voluntarily offer it, then are happy to give it, doesn't help. Still a violation. So that's also very hard to understand. You could certainly imagine a case where somebody does that, right? I need a loan right now. If I get that loan, I'll be able to profit greatly in business. I'll be very happy to share some of that profit with you. I'll be very happy to pay interest because it'll be very worth my while. Certainly easy to imagine where somebody could come to you with full sound mind and body and be very happy to offer you interest on a loan. And still, the halacha has got a problem with that as well. So that's the second thing we have to try to figure out, why that's the case. Third, yeah?
That would just mean that essentially any investment you make.
No, so we'll talk about how to deal with investments. You know, we're not going to get to it today because of time. So, in between this week and next week, you shouldn't think that there's no way to make investments in halacha, or that all the many fine, upstanding Jewish religious businessmen that you know are in big trouble. There is a way to address it, and we'll get to that. But at least theoretically, the person volunteers to pay interest, that doesn't make it any better. and he's sinning too. Doesn't help. So that's also something we have to try to figure out. Third thing is that, as we mentioned in our first class or second class, the principles that we're discussing in this class, for the most part, basically moral principles, therefore we assume they apply equally whether you're dealing with Jews or non-Jews. But when we talk about ribbis, it's clearly not the case. The Torah is very explicit. It's not a drasha. It's very clear in the psukim that the prohibition of ribbis only applies between two Jews. And that if one party is not Jewish, so then there is no prohibition to charge or to pay interest. So if this really is an offense of a moral nature, so why should we limit it to Jews? Why don't we say it's wrong to take interest from anyone? So all those questions need some explanation. So,
can you explain how Heter is going to get to?
Yeah, but we won't get to it today, though. That's what I was mentioning before, because it's a long subject. So the question Ilan's asking about is that, what I was saying before to Yonatan, is that there is a concept called Heter Iska, which makes a lot of contemporary business dealings workable within the light of ribbis. It's a very complicated thing. God willing, we'll explain it, but we're unlikely to get to it today. But again, don't walk out of here thinking terribly about all the wonderful Jewish business, but you know. We'll explain it, God willing, next week. Or you know, whatever. Anyway, so that's something we have to try to figure out. So it's interesting to note that you could have two ways to look at it. And just from a kind of a lumdisha perspective, there are those who pose the following possibility. That ribbis, we're talking about here in our business halacha class, you would think it's a topic of choshen mishpat. It's a monetary issue. Just like onah and gnevas das in the monetary context, and all other business dealings. However, there is a strong school of thought that sees ribbis as not so much of a monetary prohibition, but more of a ritual prohibition, like a kashrus violation. But essentially, it's what you might call a Yoridea principle. And you can find strong support for the idea that it's a Yoridea principle by, guess what? Looking it up in Shulchan Aruch, where it is located in Yoridea. Now, there's reasons for that. The Torah has a whole discussion about it, but it's definitely somewhat striking that you would have probably thought that where if I was writing the Shulchan Aruch, I'd put ribbis in the laws of money in Choshen Mishpat. And the fact that it ends up in Yoridea is definitely something interesting. So there is a question one could ask, a general chakira kind of about ribbis. Is it a monetary concept or is it a Yoridea concept that involves money? So you could explain either possibility the following way. If you want to say, let's say it's a monetary concept, it's a Choshen Mishpat idea. So why does it not apply universally? Why does it apply to even reasonable rates, etc., etc.? So you could say that it's an interpersonal mitzvah, it's a ben adam l'chaveru, but it's kind of an enhanced ben adam l'chaveru. It doesn't reflect basic morality, but it reflects something more than that. Basically reflects a family relationship. The Avnei Nezer, the great posek, the Sachet Shavu Rebbe, was a uniquely creative posek. So in his tshuvas, he has a lot on ribbis, and the section on ribbis has its own name, and the name of the section is Kuntras Bris Achim. So why does he call it Bris Achim? So one reason is because bris and ribbis are the same letters, it's an anagram, same letters moved around, so it's a little cutesy. But also it's because this is his theory, which is an idea that you find in the Rishonim and the Ramban and the Rashba and others, that ribbis is a way of underscoring the family relationship within the Jewish people. That everyone within the Jewish nation is supposed to see each other as brothers, Bris Achim. So yes, it's perfectly reasonable in a business context. Somebody borrows a certain amount of money, it's reasonable to say, I want a return. Right? I would have put this money in the bank or in some real estate deal if you didn't borrow it from me. So I want you to cover what I would have made. Otherwise, that's perfectly reasonable. But it's not what you would do to your brother. Your brother is in a hard time, so he needs a loan. So you're not going to say, okay, I'll give it to you, and this is my business rate. This is what I get as an increase in my business dealings. You help him out. So too, there are those who understand that's what Ribbis is about. That it's, yes, it's interpersonal, it's benadam l'chavero, but it's not the kind of interpersonal principle that's a basic reflection of morality, that it would be immoral to do anything else. It's perfectly moral to charge a return on your money. But to your brother, you wouldn't do that. And therefore, the Torah is telling us we should see each other as brothers in that sense, and that's what Ribbis is meant to underscore. Hi.
But if that's the case, it's somebody who needs the money in order to go and invest, and he knows he's going to get the return.
So you're getting into the heteristic question, so then I'll hold off for that until we get to that. Yes, sir.
Why was this this specifically lending and with interest picked as this this sort of show that it should be more like your brother?
This is considered to be one of the most basic ways in which people express chesed to each other. It's interesting. If I were to ask you to give me an example of chesed, so you'll say, Bikur Cholam, Nicham Aveil, all the ones that come to mind more readily. But in halachic sources, well, all those things are crucial, but lending money to people in need is a positive mitzvah, is a mitzvah d'oraisa. We read about just a few weeks ago in Parshas Mishpatim. And it's considered to be one of the most prominent examples of chesed. And, for example, the Chafetz Chaim wrote a whole sefer on chesed called Avos Chesed, appropriately. And about half of it is about lending money. It's just an overwhelmingly large percentage of what we talk about as emblematic of chesed. So perhaps it's saying that, okay, this is in a different context, it would be legitimate. There's nothing immoral about asking for a return, but you're supposed to see every member of the Jewish nation as a brother. Alternatively, you could say a little bit differently, and this is if you want to explain why it's more of a Yeridea kind of concept. Why is it more of a ritual idea between you and God than it is between you and the other guy? You maybe say it the following way, just to draw a comparison to explain. So in Parshas Bahar, you read about Ribbis in juxtaposition to the concept of Shemitah. So when it comes to Shemitah and all the agricultural mitzvahs in general, especially Shemitah, so we know they're often linked to the theme of Emunah. The Gemara in Shabbos says that the whole Seder Zeraim could be identified with the word Amunas. So what's the connection especially between Emunah and Shemitah? So we know the Torah says, okay, take off one out of every 7 years and don't work the field. Now, clearly, it takes a lot of faith to be able to do that and to trust that you'll make a living, that you'll survive. Normally, I got to work for a living. One out of every 7 years, I'm not going to work and I'll still survive. It takes a lot of trust. Now, let's say you were to say, all right, Rabbi, I'll observe Shemitah. I won't work for the seventh year. On one condition. You have to sign me a contract. The rabbis in town have to write me a signed contract that says that if I lose any money this year because I'm not working, you'll cover all my losses. So I can be guaranteed by the rabbis that I won't have any less money than I do when I'm working. So you might technically be still in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Shemitah, but that's clearly not so impressive. You're not really expressing very much faith at that point. You're essentially only doing it because someone signed you a contract saying that they'll make sure you're not going to suffer any financial loss. So let's say if we draw the parallel here, the Torah says as a basic expression of chesed, you have to lend money to people in need. So you say, all right, God, I'll do that. You want me to lend money to my brother? I will. On one condition. I want a signed contract that says, that guarantees me, that I will make as much as I would have, nothing fancy, I'll make as much as I would have if I left the money in the bank. If I did some low-yield investment very minor percentage, I want to guarantee that I'll be covered just as well as if I left the money in the bank or in some kind of business context. So that might be reasonable in terms of the guy borrowing the money. And he might be happy to pay it. But God's not okay with that. God says, listen, I want you to be a person of chesed and to be willing to take that risk to help out your friend. Parenthetically, it's interesting. There's a lot to discuss about the mitzvah of lending money, which is a whole separate topic. But you're not obligated to risk the principal. If you don't think the person is trustworthy, so you're not obligated to put the money itself at risk and say, give it to somebody who's not going to return it. But in terms of the profit, in terms of how you could have used this money to make money in the bank or somewhere else, and you say, I'm only going to get involved in chesed if I'm guaranteed it'll be at least as good, that's insulting to God. That's a ben adam l'makom, and you're not allowed to do that, even if the other guy cooperates, and even if he's happy to do it. And in fact, he's also in violation by agreeing to this whole arrangement. And by participating, he's also committing the same offense. So perhaps this whole conception of ribbis as a yoredeya notion, as a ritual offense that the parties are not able to even consent to, maybe reflects that kind of understanding. It's just a theory. It's also interesting to note, there was somebody once suggested, I saw in a sefer called the Siva Shalom, not to be confused with the Slonim Rebbe, and the Torah is a different Siva Shalom. So in the Siva Shalom and Hilchas Ribbis, so he raised the following issue. We mentioned in the beginning that there is a difference between Halva and She'ela. Right? So there's no prohibition of Ribbis if I lend you an item that you return to me whole, and you decide to throw in something else. Right? If I lend you my jacket, and you give me back the jacket and you say, thank you so much, and in return, here's also a watch to go with it, that's not ribbis. There's no prohibition there. So, it's an interesting question what the difference is. Because there is a concept of rental. Right? So if I have a car and I want to lend it to you, I'm entitled to charge you for the usage. That's called rental. I can give you my apartment and I can charge you for usage. There isn't a requirement that if I'm charging you, I have to let you keep the item. There is such a concept of charging for usage called rental, and it's a legitimate way of making money. So why can't I rent you out my money? Why can't I say, here's $100 and give me back an extra 10 for the usage? Hi.
Hi. When I was in yeshiva, I forgot what it was called though, but we had like a thing where people do shifts of like working, you know, helping out in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Tarnut?
Yeah, Tarnut.
Yes.
And I remember when we were yeshiva, there was like one of the, I guess someone asked one of the rabbis whether it would be an issue, let's say you had like Tarnut 1 week to trade it, let's say you're like really Shabbos and you're supposed to be there.
And it's a harder week.
Yeah, no, so yeah. You don't necessarily know. You know, because they could be 4 or 5 months in the future, you have no idea, but
right.
I've heard that there was an issue with this because it might end up being a harder week now versus, you know.
Yeah.
So why would that be? I mean, I understand.
Yeah, it's definitely not rivers derisive. We'll talk about some of the permutations, which won't be today, but we'll get into how that might fit in. So just in terms of why can't I rent out my money like I can rent out my time? So it's I can rent out my property. So it's an interesting question. And the Siva Shalom, he has a theory, which I can quibble whether it's adequate or not to explain everything. But he says that basically money has no inherent usage. Money only becomes more money because human effort grows it. So if you want to pay for the use of my car or the use of my computer or the use of my apartment, okay, so that's a valuable usage. But if you want to pay for the use of my money, so your money, my money is only valuable to you because you're going to use it through your effort to make it worth more. So for me to charge you for that, that's essentially like I'm charging you for your own self. That's how he suggests. And that's a little bit more in line. It's interesting just to be aware that despite the fact, and we'll discuss a little bit more, that we assume that ribbis is only an intra-Jewish concept, and not necessarily a moral principle, it is one that other religions have come to on their own. We know that Christianity has historically had a prohibition against interest, which is how you come to Jews being involved in money lending, because Christians wouldn't, and that's where you come on to Shylock and the like and the whole story. And Muslims also have a pretty strict prohibition of interest. which is why you have a concept today of Islamic banking, which is designed to accommodate that issue. So this is a concept that other religions have come onto on their own, and therefore there is quite a wealth of philosophy from the past 2,000 years, Christian philosophy and Jewish philosophy and others, talking about what the potential issue is. Is there some type of moral problem, not just with exploiting people, but even just the whole notion of charging for waiting or charging for money? Is there something inherently wrong with that? And there are those who have theorized that you're essentially charging for nothing because just keeping the money the same and letting them keep it for a certain period of time, that there's nothing there that you should legitimately have a claim to. That you're basically taking money without actually giving anything. So this is somewhat akin to some of those approaches, that to charge a person for their effort is somehow morally wrong. However you look at it, we have this prohibition of ribbis. And it's also fascinating to note, this is not about the details, so you know, I guess by next week we'll talk about a lot of the practical details. But just also conceptually, it's also interesting to note that among the Lamdisha halachic thinkers, there were those who said that not only is this really a ritual idea, not a monetary idea, but we could actually bifurcate the two worlds. And there are those who said that ribbis is actually a legitimate monetary debt, that if you have two people who make a contract with each other involving the payment of interest, so that contract is a legitimate contract. It's a reasonable deal, monetary deal between two people. And the halacha recognizes it on that level, while also prohibiting it at the same time. It's a little bit of a hard idea to wrap your head around, and not everyone agreed the idea exists. But to give you an example, if you want to say that it's comparable to theft, it's like I'm stealing money from you, so you have to figure out whether or not that comparison follows through. For example, if you've ever been to a wedding, so you know that, not if you've ever been, but if you pay close attention under the chuppah, so you may hear that the rabbi will often ask the chassan if the ring is his, right? He has to use his own ring in order to effectively perform kedushin to marry this woman. So what if the ring is stolen? If he stole the ring from somebody else's finger and tries to marry this woman, so it's no good. The money is not his. The kedushin is not effective. What would you say if he got the ring through ribbis? Let's say straight out full-blown ribbis. He lent somebody else $100 and said, you have to pay me back $100 and a ring. That is straight out ribbis minatara. Could he use that ring to marry a woman? So, Ilan, would you?
I would say yes, because while there's an Easter of one getting ribbis, but there's no Easter on using that ribbis, assuming.
Well, if it's comparable to theft, let's say if it's completely illegitimate, right? So then if you stole the ring, you wouldn't be able to use it. So why is this different? Yosef?
Maybe, well, it has properties of theft in it, but because it's, I mean, it's not defined as same category per se.
Well, that's the question. You know, because you could have thought that if it's essentially ill-gotten gains, so why should it be any different than theft? But there is a school of thought, many achronim, say the Mishnah Melech is one of the first who advocated this, is that it says, basically the expression is chovu v'ataras rasa, that it's a legitimate debt, that it's reasonable on the monetary level. So in Choshen Mishpat, it's mutter, and Yerodeya, the Torah forbid it. So you're not allowed to collect this ring. It's an Avera. And you have to give it back. We'll talk about that also. But as long as you have it, it's yours, and you could use it for full intents and purposes as if it's yours. So not everyone agreed with that. The Chazon Ish, for example, thought it doesn't make sense. If the Torah prohibited it, then it's not yours. But there is a school of thought that sees this as two different realms, and that it could be it's theoretically yours. I'll give you another example. Let's say somebody stole money, so he has to return it. So let's say the person who stole money dies, and his yorshim, his inheritors, now have the money. So they should return it. But let's say the father collected money with ribbis, he collected interest, and then he dies. So the inheritors are not obligated to return it. So if it's really stolen money, so then they should have to give it back. So apparently, there's an obligation to return it on the one who took it, but it's not because it's stolen money per se. And I'll give you another very practical case. This could come up all the time, and it's not a case where there really is a clear resolution. This is an ongoing machlokas. So if it comes up, you should raise the issue, but just be aware. This very practical consideration Poskim have thought about. Okay, let's say I lend Yosef money. Okay, I lend him $1,000. And I say, you got to pay me back interest. I expect you to pay me back $1,500 total. And the way we're going to do it is you're going to start making payments $100 a month for the next 15 months. And we contract that you're going to pay me the interest first. The first 5 months, you're paying me the $500 interest. And then after that, you start paying the principal, the $1,000. So let's say Yosef's been paying me for 5 months. He's paid me $500 back. And then afterwards says, by the way, I only intend on paying you $500 more. Because I'm not allowed to pay interest. We're religious Jews. I'm not allowed to pay interest. So that $500 I paid you already, it can't be interest. There's no such concept. So it was principal. I paid you half of what I borrowed. Now I only owe you $500 more. And I say to Yosef, nothing doing. You want to be religious, that's very nice. I don't really care. We contracted that you're paying me $500 interest. That's what you paid me already. You owe me the full principal. You borrowed $1,000 from me. You haven't paid a cent of that. You've only paid interest. The fact that you don't believe in it, I don't care. You don't believe it's permissible, that's your problem. I want $1,000 of the principal. You borrowed $100,000 from me. I want it back. Who's right? The fact that I'm sinning is a given. But in the monetary realm, did he pay me half the principal and he only owes me half? Or does he really owe me $1,000? And we have to work out this issue that he paid me interest. I'm really obligated to return it to him, but that's my religious obligation. And if I'm not going to do it, Yosef's up a creek.
And they're both Jews?
Yeah. If that wasn't the case, it wouldn't be an issue. So this is actually a machlokas. It's not such an easy question to answer. That do we acknowledge ribbis conceptually? It's just prohibited, and therefore, taka, he still owes me $1,000. Or do we say no? There's no legitimacy to the ribbis at all. So therefore, he paid me $500 for no reason. So it's got to be credited as half of the principal, and now he only owes me $500. It's a difficult issue. If it comes up, we have to look into it because it's a tricky question. Benjamin? Not really. I mean, it would be a prohibition. So that's a problem. But in terms of the legitimacy of the debt, in both cases, you could have a debt theoretically either way, whether it's documented or not. And that's if we say it's legitimate, then it could be in either case. So those are open questions. So just to say a few more details, we'll dive in Ma'ariv in 3 minutes, hopefully. But I'll just mention, and then we'll have to pick up from here next week, is that is biblically prohibited ribbis, is ribbis that's also min haTorah. And then there are all kinds, surprisingly many kinds, of ribbis midrabanan, rabbinically prohibited ribbis. So the only time it's ribbis doraisa is what we call ribbis ktsutza, which means I have to contract initially that that's the deal. I'm lending you $100, contract I don't mean necessarily in writing, but just that that's the deal. I'm lending you $100, you have to pay me back $110, whether I use percentage language or a dollar sum language, whatever it is, I'm lending you, you have to pay me back more. If that's not the deal at the beginning, it's not ribbis d'oraisa. It could be very easily ribbis d'rabbana in many, many cases, but for it to be ribbis min haTorah, it has to be arranged that way. Which, by the way, we could explain based on the theory we said before in terms of the offense against God. What's the aveira really against God? It's not so much that you collected interest later, that you took more money. It's that you only entered into the loan under that agreement. I'm only willing to lend you the money because you're going to agree to pay me back more. It's the agreement that's offensive. The collecting, it sounds funny, right? You think, what's the real offense in ribbis? It's taking the interest. You might think, if I make such a deal, but in the end I never take it, I'm a tzaddik, I'm great. But ironically, that's actually a clear issur d'oraisa, even if I don't end up taking the money later. That the making of the deal, that's where you have a real offense against what the Torah talks about. And then, other than that, you're going to have potentially Yisurim Drabanan. And there are many of those. God willing, we'll explain which is which a little bit next week and hopefully get into some of the Iska concepts as well, time permitting. Okay, do we have enough people willing to stay for Ma'ariv? Quick show of hands. Anyone else? Okay. Anyone else? We're halfway there. Once we got half, now we have...
I'll see you. I'll stay.
Okay.
I won't stop myself.
Thank you.
All right, have a great night.
Further
confirm.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Does he want to come join the Ma'ariv first?
Huh?
Does he want to come join us for Ma'ariv? I saw him. I saw him Monday night.
I thought I was in Queens right now.
But I saw him. I saw him Monday night. All right, so are we, everyone here is staying?
No.
Raise your hand if you're not staying. Okay, so that's probably going to do us in. Okay, we'll run across the street. Everyone should have a wonderful night. I will have a Freilich and Purim. Good Tanya Sester. Any good... Who's on Purim? Sorry? In terms of which? Of that half of it? Which Purim?
No.
That what?
You don't want to drink that.
We got rated 100 out of 100 from 50 people. Certified in New York. We can get, he has references we can call. This is the best website I've ever seen.
So let's get him.
Why wouldn't we do this? I, you saw the people I had? That's the first quote. Remember, how you going to get 50?
What was?
Oh, now you're going to read it. Now you're going to read it. I sent you a million emails.
I was trying to tell you.
Want to chop chop? Well, I haven't seen you check an email.
I suck at
email. Seriously? By the way, that was the most offensive paragraph I've ever read.
Because I was like, all right, I'm going to chop it online right now. I'll see, I knew it was going to be offensive.
It was very offensive.
I cursed.
That's not the problem. The problem was it was like crude. Like it wasn't even like funny. It was just offensive.
But like, at the same time,
it's not wrong.
It's just,
yeah, I know.
Anybody know this recorded system?
It's not necessarily work.
What?
Anybody
know
this? No, sorry. How you doing, Hudson?
Thank God. How are you, Alex?
Doing well. Thank you.
I'm like, that's the problem. So me?